Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, nerds. Welcome to episode 540 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast, presented by Overdrive. Just Adam today, and I have a really, really delightful and important conversation for you on this episode with author Joan F. Smith. Joan has a new book that just came out, or rather is just about to come out, depending on when you listen to this. If you listen to it on Monday, it comes out on Tuesday, April 20th. So it's a must read. But the book is called The Half Orphan's Handbook, and it's a coming of age story for sure, but it deals with the main character's father committed suicide. So obvious trigger warnings for suicide and grief. But this is something that unfortunately Joan had to go through when she was younger. And it's the book itself though is funny and heartbreaking, but also heart mending. I just loved it so freaking much. And it's very authentic when it comes to the exploration of grief and, you know, kind of how we all deal with trauma in different ways. And one of those ways might be humor sometimes, and a mix of humor and tragedy and grief. And just, oof, it's such a wonderful, wonderful book. And this conversation was delightful. It was very kind of cathartic. Talked about a lot about grief of not only the pandemic, but some stuff that we have both gone through in our lives. It was just a really very joyous conversation. And I feel very delighted to now know Joan. So I am very lucky there. But The Half Orphan's Handbook is an absolute must read. If you would like to get a hold of us, you can always email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds, or just go to our website, ProfessionalBookNerds.com, and that's where you can find all of our old episodes, and you can search for specific genres or authors or books and find all the episodes where we've talked about those or with those particular authors. If you haven't yet, if you want to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, that helps people find us a little bit more easily. And I think that's about everything. If you want some Professional Book Nerd swag, you can go to shop.overdrive.com. We also have some lovely Libby hoodies there and tote bags and all sorts of good stuff. So I think that's everything. I don't want to keep you guys any longer. I just want you to be able to enjoy this conversation with Joan F. Smith on the Professional Book Nerds podcast. Fabulous. All right. Well, I will do an intro like after the fact by my like in myself and stuff. But what we always kind of have our authors do is kick us off by introducing their book. So would you like to introduce our listeners to The Half Orphan's Handbook? And that way I don't give away too much of your plot.
Sure thing. So the book is about 16-year-old Lila Cunningham, and she unexpectedly loses her dad to suicide. She creates a series of rules to help prevent herself from feeling that kind of pain again. And this gets pretty complicated when she goes to a main grief camp where she meets a bunch of new people and falls in love with somebody who might not be who he says he is. So it's this coming of age story where she's trying to figure out why her dad did what he did in order to heal.
So for people who may not be familiar with your life, what made you want to write about this particular topic?
Absolutely. So I lost my dad to suicide, and Unfortunately, I was a teenager during the first attempt that I knew about, and I was a teenager for the second attempt that I knew about too. And then a couple of years after that, he did die by suicide. And it was very unexpected the first attempt. It was like everybody who found out about him when he finally did pass was shocked, because that was not his like outward presentation. He was very happy-go-lucky, and he was like the dad that all the friends would call if there was a rough spot in the middle of the night and needed a ride. Like, that was the guy who would take you home. And so I carried the character of Lila around with me for a long time, because I knew I wanted to write about her, but I just didn't know where to put her yet. And then once the grief camp kind of came to light, I was like, okay, that's where she's going.
Was that something, the grief camp thing? Because I have a story that I'll get to in a little bit later. That's not entirely similar, but also unfortunately tragic. And like, I remember, basically when I was 10 years old, my best friend and I saw his father have a stroke and he ended up passing away. And, we were like in the room, it was just the three of us in there. And so it was obviously very traumatic, and they sent us to counseling, obviously, because, you know, our parents aren't monsters. But like, I remember very little of it, but it was more of like a one-on-one and then like really small group stuff. But like, was the grief camp, was that something that you just kind of came up with, or was that something that you experienced after you went through everything you did with your father?
So the grief camp that I wrote is the place I wanted to go to. But it either didn't exist then, or we didn't have that kind of resource to get there. There's like some socioeconomic stuff in the book too, where Lila's feeling like she can't afford to be there, which was very much my family as well. But basically, when I was in my, I think, late 20s, I had the idea for this character and I just didn't know where to put her. And then I had a fever and I didn't know it yet. And I was on a plane and I was going to the AWP conference out in LA. And I read an article about the closure of a camp from 9/11. So all the kids who lost parents were invited to this camp every year, and like they could be with people who understood the kinds of things that they went through. But then all those kids grew up, so they had no need for the camp anymore. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this random camp, and this one was in the Berkshires. It's gone. Like, why? There's now this space. What to do with that? And I was like, oh, I could put her there.
Yeah. Two things. One, I in your bio, you mentioned, just speaking of being on a plane, like you mentioned doing your best writing on a plane. And like, I felt that on a visceral level. That's like one of the things I honestly miss most about traveling. Cause in my normal life, I travel like once a month for work. And I, same thing, like I'm an aspiring author. Like, I feel like I write more on planes than anywhere else. So I feel you on a cellular level there. But also something, there's this concept that I can't stop thinking about. We've had some family unfortunate situations over in the pandemic. And there's just like this concept that I always think about when someone passes away, or even just like when you have a huge momentous occasion where like there's this concept of you're just kind of supposed to move on eventually. And like, and it's fucking heartbreaking, honestly. Like, you know, it's like there is, and you talk about it a little bit at the beginning of the book where like their family is like, yeah, people brought us casseroles and they would check in on us. But then like eventually your friends feel awkward and they just stop texting you to hang out. And it's just like, I don't know. I'm just really glad that your book addresses this, because again, this isn't even like a question I kind of told you before we started recording. Like, this is going to be like more of a conversation than like a bunch of questions, but like, it's so like heartbreaking that you are just expected to be like, all right, Joan, yeah, your dad died, but move on. And it's just like, I don't know. I feel like it's something that needs to be talked about.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember like the casseroles are real, like that stuff comes in. People brought cookies, people brought so much stuff and like blankets and all these things. And I wasn't living at home anymore. I just moved out. And then I returned home. And I remember the first thing I ate after my dad died was a salted biscotti, which I'd never had before. And that flavor is just like embedded in my brain. And then like the next day it was freezing and people commented on the weather, and then like somebody laughed and I was like, what? Like, people can still laugh? But like life just does go on. And I also unfortunately lost one of my best friends in my early 20s. He died in a car accident. Yeah. And like the next day, it was like a beach day practically. Like it's unbelievable, but it does go on.
Yeah. I kept thinking about the food thing just because, like I said, my best friend, his name's Kurt. We're still really, really close. Like our families are, in the sense, like his family grew up in the house that my mom's dad built. Like we literally lived around. It was just like this weird thing where like they have four kids and it's two girls, two boys. We have four kids, two girls, two boys. And like our ages, he was born 25 days before me. Like it's just weird connections. So we're still really close. But like I specifically remember him too. Like he went into shock basically in the sense like he didn't cry during his dad's funeral, during the wake, anything like that. And I remember like sitting there, we were 10 years old. And I remember him like looking in their basement, like everyone was, you know, doing the like post funeral, like kind of awake, kind of like a somber, like let's have drinks to celebrate Tom. And I remember him looking at me at 10 and being like, there's so many damn sandwiches down here. Yeah. And it was like the first time I heard him laugh. Cause he's like, what do they think we're going to do with all of this shit? And I don't know. It's just like, it's such a weird concept. It is. Cause it's just like, well, we've done our part. And I'm not even thinking that I like expect people who know someone who's gone through a tragedy, like to know what to do, which is why I love your book so much, because it's like, it's not their fault that they don't know how to keep helping you.
No. And that's why too, I wrote a lot of what I think at least is funny, like humor in the book, because like those moments, like your friend laughing about the sandwiches, like that's part of what I think being human is. Like the weirdest thing that ever could have possibly happened was obviously my dad's death was a major tragedy and it was so life altering. And the morning after he died, my mom woke up to an email from her boss that said that she was dead. So her entire school system, she was a teacher, got an email that my mother had died because they got the information wrong.
Oh my God.
And that was like the hardest you could ever laugh.
Yeah.
It was so bizarre, but it's those moments you have to find it.
Somewhat along those same lines, back in December, I grew up and I had an uncle who kind of lived with us every other weekend because he was divorced, but he had a daughter. He lived in Michigan and we lived in just outside of Cleveland, and he would come. So like literally my entire childhood, he would come, and every other weekend he would live with us with my cousin Caitlin. And so we were really, really close, and he was sick a lot of his life, but at the end of last year, he got really, really sick, had to go to a hospital. They had to amputate his leg, and like it went horribly. And he ended up passing away just from complications. And it was something where, like, obviously it's the middle of a pandemic, and like we just decided to have a funeral, and like everyone was as safe as they could be. Like my brother and I did the eulogy, and like it was very emotional. And then, like, it's our family, one of our family's traditions is to do, you know, some kind of shot for like Christmas, whatever. Like for some reason my grandpa drank peach schnapps as like one of the many things he drank. I don't know why he couldn't have chosen a better alcohol. But like we finished the funeral, and like I had brought peach schnapps for, I have a huge family, so there was like 30 cousins there, and we all did a shot, and my cousin Caitlin, whose dad had just passed away, was like sobbing, and we're standing in a freezing cold parking lot because we can't go anywhere because it's the pandemic. And she just looks at us all and she's like, we do a shot, we, you know, cheers Uncle Mylon. And then she just looks at us all, she's like, now what the hell do we do? And like everyone just started laughing. It is like, it's just like, I don't know. The comedy that you put in this book is, I think it's essential, because like how else are you supposed to freaking deal with everything?
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. It's all those moments though that make it memorable, I think, too. Mm-hmm. And help you start to grieve.
Yeah. Have you had, I mean, I know your book is coming out this year, but you were clearly like working on edits, I imagine, things like during the pandemic and stuff. Like, have you found dealing with the pandemic, was it all kind of similar to how you felt when you found out everything about your dad?
Not dissimilar. I think that there are definitely some moments in there that like you're panicky, right? Like especially at the beginning when you're wiping down groceries and mail and you're like, this is my life now. And plus, you know, I have two little kids, so having them home all the time, all of a sudden, like my husband owns a company, I work a full-time job, and it was like a lot at once and then like no more time for me. And also I feel like the whole world kind of had their anxiety turned up on high. So mental health has been, you know, spotlighted a little bit more than it was pre-pandemic maybe. There are definitely some similarities to grieving what my life was. And, you know, also the uncertainty of the future, because I think that as things start to return back to normal, there will be some changes. And that is not dissimilar to that experience for sure.
Yeah. And I think it's, I don't know, I'm almost getting this feeling, our office is getting ready in June. We're going to do like a sort of back in the office, sort of not, and they're going to be very smart about it. But it's like, as much as I want life to return to normal, and I think I've felt this after like tragedies and things in my life too, like as much as I want life to return to normal, I almost feel safe in this kind of like cocoon that I'm in. I'm like doing this every single day and like staying home and not going and seeing my friends or family, even like talk on FaceTime and everything. But like, I don't know. I feel like I keep that feels so much like dealing with like a death in the family or like a tragedy, just because it's like, I don't know that I want to move on from this sadness. Makes sense.
It does. And I think in some ways, like reemergence is actually going to be more difficult than the initial like lockdown or lock in kind of for sure.
Do you remember, like, you know, you talked about laughing because of the absurd email that your mom got. Do you remember like if that there were like specific times that it did start to feel, I don't want to say normal, that your dad was gone, because obviously like you can't replace a parent, but like, do you remember ever feeling a sense of normalcy and like how you were able to get there? I'm just thinking of like people who may go through the things that you've gone through and may hear this and may read your book, like almost like fence posts or like benchmarks for them to know like, okay, maybe I am getting a little bit okay. I know everyone's different, but like, were there things for you that you're like, oh, okay, maybe I can do this?
So many things. Yeah. I mean, so right, I was just about to start writing my MFA thesis when my dad died, like literally the same week. And then I had to complete the thesis. And that was like an exercise in like mind control, practically, like being able to sit down and write a story, and like parts of that story, I never really finished it, to be honest with you, but parts of it were really inspired by his family too, which was difficult. So I felt like I was like really mired into like his kind of universe. A friend of mine just lost her brother this year, and I talked to her a lot about how the first year is really difficult, because like the first birthday or like our Christmas that year, he died like 3 weeks before. So we had no tree. Like our presents were on like a table. It was just like a really sad, sad thing. And then at some point you do try to reclaim it. So like I watched a funny movie. I went out to dinner, and like I tried to kind of peel the Band-Aid off bit by bit. And like when I would try something, it would work or it wouldn't. And then I had therapy, which was fantastic. And bit by bit, I mean, I really think that time is such a bomb.
I think one of the things I struggle with, I am terrible at giving myself grace for anything, like at all. And I even like knowing that about myself is almost kind of funny, because I'm like, you're terrible giving yourself grace. You can accept that part, but you can't like do it. Or like I'll start feeling shitty that I am not able to kind of like turn a corner. Like I'll feel guilty that I feel bad, you know, and like I do the whole like, look at everything I have, what's your problem type of a thing. And it's almost like 100%. A spiral.
Yep.
I imagine though, that's probably not, I hope you could give yourself some grace after everything you went through. Like, again, like I struggle because I'm like, oh, I kind of miss my family. And then like, that's a perfectly good reason to be sad. But
everybody has it. I mean, everybody has it. Like, I have to say, okay, Joan, like give yourself grace. And I kind of laugh at that because I'm not good at it either. But like, at least if I say it, then I'm attempting. And I mean, like parenting is an exercise in absolute guilt futility, because if I take the time for me to like do my things, we call it filling the cup at home, because my kids get furious when I'm like doing something without them. Yeah. But I'm like, listen, like mommy is a writer and I need time to fill my cup. So I'm going to go do this, and then I'm going to sit there and do it and feel guilty for not being with them. But then like, if I'm with them, I'm guilty for not writing. Like it's, Everything, you know, I think it's just like you level up to a new area and then you're still the same person.
Were we separated at birth? Like, I feel so. Like I'm talking to myself right now.
I think so.
No one can see this. We're literally wearing the same like color pink on this conversation, which is
pretty fantastic.
Yeah. There you have this quote in the book that I love because it's so true about grief. And I think it'll really help people understand that they don't need to feel guilty. It's I think it's like halfway through and they're talk and it's like really the first time. Is it Lila?
It's Lila.
Lila. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is my brain. Lila is talking to some friends that she meets at this camp. And it's like kind of the first time that she says, like, how do you guys deal with this? And somebody says something along, it might be Noah, it might be one of her girlfriends, something along the lines of like, it's like climbing up a mountain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you're going up, maybe you'll find like a tunnel. But it doesn't matter like what gear you have or what route you have. Maybe there's another mountain after, like you're still climbing a fucking mountain.
Yeah.
And like, I like put the book down and I was like, Joan sees into my soul. And I just, I don't know. Like, again, not a question, but it's just like, I don't think people understand that whether they're going through something or they've never had to go through something tragic, like it's okay not to be okay kind of a thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that passage actually is almost completely unchanged, I think, from where I first wrote it. And I remember writing that moment. That's, I think that's Winnie who says it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like no matter what, like we're all going through this game of life. And like sometimes we're going to win, sometimes we're going to lose. Mm-hmm. And no matter what, like we're still doing it, basically. Yeah. And I'm obsessed with the things that like, I don't know what comes after life. And that is basically why I'm a writer, I think, because mm-hmm. there's unanswered questions in the world. So yeah, I think about that stuff all the time.
I remember like after my friend's dad passed away, like 2 years later, my grandfather passed away. And it like, definitely wasn't he was a grandfather. He was a little older. He was sick. It wasn't like a tragedy, but I remember being like 13 years old and sitting in my bed, not being able to fall asleep because I would go through like super healthy thing for a 13 year old. Like I would go through like, okay, well, do we have a carbon monoxide? That was the time when like carbon monoxide was a huge like terror that everyone mm-hmm. was apparently afraid of. I was like, well, do we have a carbon monoxide thing? Like, what if our house catches on fire? Like, what if I get cancer in the middle of the night? Like, because I don't know like that. I'm so jealous of people who can just like embrace life and I'm not like, and they're never worried.
I can't even begin to relate more to you right now. Like, are my burners off? Are the doors locked? It's all I think about.
That OCD where I'm like 13 years old going down, checking our locks as if my parents haven't done the same thing.
Yep.
To take a complete left turn, you have a really cool job. You're a writer in residence at a library.
Yeah.
What does that entail? Because I want it.
It was a bucket list item for me and I cannot begin to tell you how excited I am about it. So it's my local town library. They started it this year in honor of a board member named Herb Voigt. And basically what it is I am the writer in residence, so I'm going to answer questions that patrons might have. I am going to put on a couple workshops that are writing related mostly. Mm-hmm. I am going to finish at least one project, and my goal is actually to finish two that my agent can then kick into the stratosphere and then make some book recommendations.
Yeah.
So that's the goal. Yeah.
Do you know what kind of seminars and type things you're gonna like set up for people? Like, is it, I'm almost envisioning like a creative writing class type of a thing. Like, do you know what you're gonna put together for patrons rather?
I think so. Yeah. I started kicking around a couple of different ideas. One of them, I'm very into setting and place and like sensory details and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then coming out of the pandemic, as we all have, like, I'm probably going to kind of wrap that in for a class for adults. And then I think we're going to do one for teens about like dialogue and what they actually want to read instead of what all the grownups in the world think that they want to read. So.
You're not just going to suggest Catcher in the Rye.
No, I am not. Honestly. Nope.
It's crazy. Like if you give a child a book that's actually, you know, interesting and modern, they actually do like reading. It's, you know, as opposed to forcing them.
Yeah, it's revolutionary. You know, I think that there are new classics and those are great.
Yeah. I grew up, my mom was a teacher for 40 years. And so like, and she taught third and fourth grade, but we were a very literary house, but like, and I grew up reading, but I remember like the first time I read a book in school that I didn't actively hate was Princess Bride when I was, I think, a sophomore in high school. I remember actively like telling the teacher like, "Hey, we should read more books that aren't trash. Like, what do you, what are your thoughts on that?" Yeah. Was writing this book cathartic for you, or do you think that you're far enough removed from everything that's happened where it was more so just getting a story down on the page?
No, it was so enormously cathartic for me. Absolutely. This is actually, it's the first book I ever finished. So it took me, you know, I think 5 months to draft the first draft, but then actually like the first draft, I mean, it's unrecognizable from then, and going through the revision, cause I had to keep like examining the exact same passages over and over again. And then I'd like try to make it a little bit more authentic based on how I felt or based on how I completely didn't feel. Going through that and through that and through that absolutely was a form of catharsis.
Yeah. Were there parts that felt more challenging than others to write, whether it's specific voices or specific scenes or things that like, was there stuff that you found yourself struggling? As I've told you before we started recording, I was like a puddle reading it the whole time. So I imagine you were probably the same writing it, but like, were there parts that were more challenging for you?
The parts that were a little tough were finessing. There's like a little bit of a subplot with like girl drama kind of, and I didn't want it to be like girl hate, like that kind of thing. So making sure that it didn't come off that way was really important to me. And then some parts that were difficult were, there's like a kind of like a twist, I guess I'll say, but that scene that happens toward the end, I had to revisit a lot too.
Yeah. Did you write this kind of the initial draft anywhere, like linearly, like from start to finish?
Nope.
No. Did you kind of always know how you wanted to reach a conclusion though? Or was it just like, I'm going to start and we'll just see where this goes?
So I am a big time outliner now. Yeah. That book, my process has kind of always been the same, but what I do is I write everything that I know is going to happen, like the key scenes, the pivotal scenes, the scenes I'm excited to write. And then I go back and I reverse outline. Yeah. So I have a picture of like a index covered bulletin board of this book, and like the scenes that are already written are pink, and then the ones that I need to write are yellow. So once I get through everything that I'm like excited to do, I start from the top and write linearly to get all the way through the story.
That is extremely smart. I the draft of the book I'm working on, like I have it in a Google Doc, which is probably not the best way to do it, but in like a, I don't know, fit of creativity or something, like I thought of like the last like 30 pages and just wrote all those out. And so now I'm like trying to get to that.
Yeah, totally.
But like anytime I open up the Google Doc, I have to scroll all the way down and I just have like in the bold letters and like the ending. And I'm like, God damn it. I just got to, I want to get them. Like, I almost wish I hadn't written that, because I'm just like, it reminds me that I'm like, oh, I have so far to go before I get to there. So
I know that part's hard.
So towards the end of our episodes, we like to ask 9 questions. We call the Nerd 9.
Okay.
I like alliteration. So the first one is, what is the last book you finished reading?
So I just finished The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which was so good. And now I'm knee deep in Angeline Bouley's The
Firekeeper's Daughter.
Firekeeper's Daughter, yeah.
Yeah, okay, wow, we are seriously simpatico. So Angeline and the narrator were on the podcast a couple weeks ago. And so delightful.
I saw that. I didn't listen yet because I was afraid that there would be a spoiler. But
no, we can't. We stay kind of, I almost felt like they were such sweethearts. They, because of the voice of the character and like the fact that it's a kind of a Native American setting, Angeline was very involved in the selection of the narrator. And, but they had never actually like met in person. So I felt like I was actually just kind of like intruding on a budding friendship. It's delightful. Addie LaRue is oof.
Oh, so good. So creative. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite place to read?
I don't. I read every day, kind of all over the place. So I hop around. Let's
Yeah.
say bed though, because I have to read every night before I go to bed.
That's fair. Do you remember the book that kind of made you fall in love with reading when you were a kid?
A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. I read it like way too young. But and there were all these words, and actually, like if I find my first copy, I underlined all the words I didn't know. Which were thankfully I didn't know them, some of them, but yeah, definitely that book. Like the concept of this girl living in New York City, Brooklyn, like I 100 years ago, just like I fell in love with that world.
I feel like every author I've ever talked to has mentioned a book that they literally will say, like, I definitely read that too young. Like, I feel like that's like an author rite of passage to read like something way heavier than you probably should have when you were
Totally.
younger. That's
My college
incredible.
essay was about that book too, actually, now that I think of it.
Ah,
So,
that's
yeah.
awesome. When we're allowed to travel again, what is one place you'd like to go to that you have not yet been to?
Oh, such a good one. I would really, really like to go to London. I technically was there, I guess, on a layover, but
No, you're good. That
it
doesn't
doesn't
count.
count. Yeah, I want to go to London.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite holiday to celebrate?
Thanksgiving, not for like the cultural terribleness of it,
Right.
but I in high school, my mom and dad hosted all my best friends Thanksgiving morning for breakfast, and we've done it every single year since. So Thanksgiving morning, all of my old best friends come over for breakfast, and now all their kids and their partners or what have you come over too. It's amazing.
See, hosting breakfast, my sister does this. My oldest sister does this too. It's such a flex because her and her husband will have everyone over for breakfast or like brunch, usually after like we're one of those annoying families who does like 5 mile and 10 mile races and everything every holiday.
Fantastic. Yep.
But then what my this is such a flex because they will like they'll do brunch and then my mom or my other sister will do Thanksgiving dinners. But my oldest sister Heather is just like, yeah, when we gotta clean up and stuff. So like by like 3 in the afternoon, they're just day drinking and watching football and just like living the life. And I'm like, man, the fact that you got to just choose that as your the thing they host, what a flex.
Relatable. Yep.
Yeah. Are you a coffee person or a tea person?
I am a coffee person and a tea person, actually,
Okay.
but I drink black coffee. That's it, pretty much.
Cats or dogs?
I'll pick dogs. I'll pick dogs.
Favorite food?
I'm very into frittatas lately, which is the most bizarre answer, but I needed to eat more spinach in my diet, so I've been eating a ton of feta frittatas. But I mean, definitely pizza. Homemade pizza on the grill.
And then if you could have dinner with one person alive or dead, who would you pick?
I'd pick my dad for sure. Yeah.
I've rarely been more certain of an answer from someone when asking that question. Okay, last question for you. What do you hope that readers take away from the Half-Orphans Handbook?
Hope that readers take away that there is a way to change how you feel and how you think. And a lot of that can be done with therapy, but it can also be done like, with self-help books or whatever it might be. I think that it's really important for us to destigmatize mental health because that's just one extra barrier in the way to getting what you need. And I really hope that readers can see that healing is possible and that hope is possible too.
Well, your book like tore me apart and put me back together like 17 different times. And I know everyone who picks it up is gonna just absolutely adore it. Joan, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Adam. This has been awesome.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.